Good evening. Great to see everyone out tonight. We are blessed tonight, brethren, to have Brother Nathan Ward with us, who's going to be leading us in our study about why should you follow a 2,000-year-old book. This is our first Wednesday night in our special series in April, the Answers in April series, and we're so glad that you're here and part of it. We want to give Brother Ward all the time that he deserves for this important subject. But suffice it to say, we're glad that you're here. If you're a guest with us, we hope that you got one of the connection cards on the way in. It'll take a moment to fill that out. Stick around after services for a moment. Get to know us. We'd like to get to know you. In just a moment, I'm going to lead us in a word of prayer. The rest of the class time will be given to Brother Ward to lead us in this study. At the conclusion, there will be a bell, and so parents will know when to go get their small children. We'll all come together here. Brother Ward's going to bring a short invitation. We'll have a song, a little devotional time. And so that's the way things are going to work tonight. We're really glad you're here. We're really excited about the subject. And so let's bow our heads together. Our great God and Father, we appreciate so much your goodness to us. You give us our life and our breath. We move through you, Father, and by your will and by your grace. And we have come together in this place because we want to encourage one another to love and good works. We want to know your word. We want, Father, to know you so that we might follow you and serve you well. We're so thankful that Brother Ward's come our way tonight, and not just him, but also his family. We pray, Father, that you might bless them for their good work and evangelism among the 58th Street congregation, as well as teaching the Bible at Florida College. And we know we're going to benefit, Father, from what he's going to share with us tonight. May we approach this study with an open heart and open mind to take your truth into our lives. Pray, Father, that all is done this night. It's for your glory. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Brother Ward.
Well, good evening. It's good to be here. You'll have to forgive me. I'm going to skip a lot of time on the pleasantries and the humorous anecdotes that preachers are supposed to start with. I've wound up with probably about 5 or 6 lessons worth of material in one outline that I'm trying to condense and move through as quickly as I can. And so I'm going to do 2 things. One of those is stick to my outline as much as I can. I'd like to be more extemporaneous as I speak, and you probably would like that as well. But if I have any hope of getting through all of this, I'm going to have to stick with it and plow ahead. I certainly welcome questions for clarification. I'm going through just a few examples of a whole bunch of different kinds of things. I can speak to you, I can email with you, I can direct you to great books and great videos that talk about some of these kinds of things as well if you want more information. So that's the real problem of what I'm dealing with in terms of the amount of information that I'm covering. So, sorry, no pleasantries, no humor. Well, maybe some humor later on, we'll see. Let's start with what I think are some bad reasons to follow the Bible. I mean, our question is, why should we follow a 2,000-year-old book? It's really easy to come up with bad reasons for this. In fact, Max Dawson spoke on a topic similar to this back at the lectureship at Florida College several years ago, and he had a list of things that I thought was helpful, and I've kind of taken that list and modified it and made it my own a little bit. But I think it's a great place to start this discussion, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on these issues. You can think through some of these things some more on your own as well. But let's begin with this, at least, admitting the fact that there are really, really dumb reasons to follow the Bible that people come up with sometimes. Probably chief among them is what you might call blind faith. This is a spot where society has so hijacked our thinking that we have sometimes bought in to their absurdities. What skeptics shout as loud as they can from the rooftop is that faith is belief without evidence, or faith is belief in spite of evidence. And we've kind of bought into that sometimes. My friends, biblical faith is not faith without evidence. The Bible is constantly calling its readers to think and to reason and to consider and to evaluate and to believe on the basis of evidence. God does not want blind faith. God wants thinking faith. It is a step that you have to take. It is not proof, but it is not blind, at least not biblical faith. It is not holier to have blind faith. It is not indicative of a stronger faith to have blind faith. It is unbiblical to have blind faith. Secondly, it's a bad reason to believe the Bible just because your parents believed. It's a really, really easy thing to do to just let inertia carry you through your whole life. You just do what you've always done because it's the easy thing to do. Your parents believed, you heard the things that they said, and so you just keep coasting through the rest of your life. But again, if biblical faith is not blind faith, if biblical faith is thinking faith, if God is calling you not to mere intellectual assent in His existence, but to a relationship with Him, then your faith must be your own. Now understand, there's nothing wrong with coming from a family of believers. A lot of us come from families of believers. That's a good thing. That can be a fantastic blessing. It can have its own downsides as well as far as it goes. But there's nothing wrong with coming from a family of believers. But your faith must be your own. I mean, what if they believed the Book of Mormon? What if they were Muslims? You can't just coast on what you've heard your whole life. It's not good enough that your parents believed. Your faith must be your own. Some people like the Bible because they think it makes them a better person. The Bible teaches fantastic moral and ethical principles. If you follow the Bible, it can make you a better person. If the world followed the Bible, it would make it a better world. I mean, you think about this for a second. What if everyone actually followed the golden rule? And how much better would that be? I mean, what if everyone actually lived in monogamous relationships for their entire lives? Lifelong monogamy. I mean, STDs are gone in like one generation at that point. Fantastic things would happen if everyone followed the Bible. And there may be some practical value in your life to following it, and that might give you some practical reason from following it, but other books can do that too. There's a whole lot of different books out there that make you better people. In different kinds of ways. And this isn't a book that is here to make you a better person in some superficial way. This is a book to overhaul who you are. This is a book that tells you it's not enough to be a better person, that you can't possibly be a better person, that you have to completely deconstruct yourself and reconstruct yourself in someone else's image, that you must die to yourself daily. That's a whole different kind of thing. And you need more than just, it'll superficially make you a better person as a reason to follow this book. The Bible claims more than mere moral and ethical advice. And the kinds of claims that it makes needs more support than a book of morals and a book of ethics would need. Fourth, it's a bad reason to follow the Bible only because it fills an emotional void in your life. You've heard people talk about this God-shaped hole that resides within everybody. You may have heard it from a variety of sources. It goes all the way back at least to Augustine, who said, "You have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." Pascal said something like that as well. C.S. Lewis is probably the quote that you're most familiar with. "If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world." Isn't that just a great thought? There is a God-shaped void in your life, and anything else you try to fill it with, it's not going to fit. And it's not going to satisfy, and only God can fill that. And I agree with that completely in principle. But there's a difference between God filling a God-shaped void in your life and feeling good because you read a book. And a lot of people get an emotional satisfaction from reading the Bible, and they think that's enough to tell them they should follow this book. There's some sort of spiritual satisfaction, however they might define that. And that's enough to tell them that they should follow this book. But mere emotional satisfaction, mere spiritual satisfaction in some enigmatic kind of way is not the same thing as God filling the God-shaped void in your life. It's not the same thing as a relationship with God that is rooted in you overhauling your entire life. Those are very different things. And those are the kinds of claims and demands that the Bible makes. And those are the kinds of claims and demands that we must be able to support if we're going to say that we should follow this book. And finally, then, a bad reason to follow the book is merely because it claims to come from God. Now, this is something that is called a necessary but not sufficient claim. Now, what that means is that there is no reason whatsoever to follow the Bible or to expect that the Bible came from God if it doesn't make the claim. It is necessary for the Bible to make the claim if you're going to think that it came from God. I mean, how many books have you seen that you have read over the course of your life that you think came from God? Well, one probably is about it. Now, if you've converted from some other religion, maybe there was another one in the past, but basically one is what it boils down to. Well, one of the chief reasons you've never entertained that issue about any other book is because the rest of the books that you've read never claimed to come from God. If the claim isn't there, you don't give it a second thought. I mean, you don't pick up a John MacDonald novel and think, I bet God sent this. You just don't think it. Now, if it claims it, then you have to think about it a little bit more. Probably you would just dismiss it, but you still have to at least think about it a little bit. So it is necessary, but it's not sufficient. And it's not sufficient because the claim alone doesn't prove the claim. Many books make this kind of claim, and you don't believe the rest of them. Well, why not? Well, maybe it's just because your parents didn't believe those. Maybe it's because they don't feel an emotional need in your life. And again, I would suggest you need more than those kinds of things. But fundamentally, just because a book makes the claim is not a reason to follow the claim, to believe the claim. So it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. So here are a few things to think about, at least at the outset, of bad reasons to follow the Bible. Why should we follow a 2,000-year-old book? Well, no one of these, I think, is sufficient in answering it. And I would say on top of that, if you pile all five of them together, it's still not really sufficient to give you a good reason to follow the Bible. But I also want to flip this to the other side and offer what I think are some bad reasons not to follow the Bible. The kinds of things that skeptics would say about the Bible that I think are just as bad as far as reasoning goes. Why should we not follow a 2,000-year-old book? Well, chief among those reasons is because it's 2,000 years old. That's a bad reason not to follow a book, just because it's old. C.S. Lewis, again, if I can invoke his name another time tonight, speaks of what he calls chronological snobbery. The way that he defines this is the uncritical acceptance of the intellectual climate of our own age and the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that count discredited. To simplify that a bit, what it means is if it's old, it must be wrong. If it's new, it must be right. What this boils down to a lot is we've made a whole lot of progress in knowledge. We know a whole lot more. Look at our technological advances. Look at the things that we can study and that we can see that we've not been able to study and see before. Look how brilliant we are as a society. And all of the people who lived before us, they were hopelessly ignorant, pagans that just believed anything that ever came their way. Well, let me suggest to you two problems or three problems with chronological snobbery. First, they weren't all ignorant. You know, Pythagoras was arguing for the rotundity and the free suspension of the earth long before Jesus was on the planet. And there's that whole Pythagorean theorem thing as well. They accomplished things that we can't even understand. You know, if they're so stupid and we're so brilliant, why is it that we still haven't figured out how they built the pyramids? And they built the pyramids? I mean, these guys weren't just a bunch of idiots living back then. They weren't just ignorant. And then it's a self-defeating sort of thing as well when you stop and you think about it. Because what does it say about today's knowledge? What does it say about the shelf life of today's great thinkers? It's a bit like, this isn't an exact analogy, but it's a bit like bad-mouthing your parents in front of your children. You're just asking for it is what you're doing there. Well, the same thing is going on here. Everyone who lived before us was ignorant. Well, what is the next generation going to say about you? Your intelligence, your influence is very short-lived along these lines. And whether you're thinking about Babylonian or Egyptian mathematics or astronomy, from arithmetic to calculus and beyond, or whether you're thinking about the great thinkers like Aristotle to Confucius to anywhere in between, I mean, there are things that have lasted the course of time that people look to and they say, look at the brilliance of what these people said. And now there's not universal agreement on all of the things that all of these people have said all the way down the line, but no one would toss out everything Aristotle said simply because it's old. No one would do that. No one would toss out what Pythagoras did just because it's old. Just because it's old is a bad reason to eliminate something from consideration. And the reason why that is because truth is an objective thing. Truth, by its very definition, excludes its opposite. And this is understood, and this is recognized, and this is acknowledged in math and in the hard sciences, and in life in general. I mean, we know how this works with gravity, right? Nobody's going to walk to the top of a building and say, I'm a relativist, I don't think gravity's true. It's not my truth today, and step off the edge and think that's going to change the nature of existence. You can't say that today is Wednesday, and it's also Thursday, and it's also Saturday. That does not work in real life. 2 + 2 = 4. It does not equal 5 or 7 or 22 or giraffe. It equals 4, and that's all they can ever equal. Because truth is an objective thing that excludes its opposite by definition. Yet in religion, yet in morality, yet in philosophy, people somehow expect relativism to work somehow. All religions basically teach the same thing. That's something that ignorant people who haven't studied religions say. Because they don't teach the same thing. And if you just look at them for more than 5 seconds, it's clear they don't teach the same thing. Every religion has a part of the truth. Religious belief is too culturally or historically conditioned to be true. You're only a Christian because your parents were a Christian. Well, yeah, you're only a relativist because your parents were a relativist too. I mean, that goes both ways. There is something objective about reality that we need to wrap our minds around and deal with. And here's the thing. If truth is objective, if truth is a real thing that can be quantified, if truth cannot change from person to person or from situation to situation, then it can neither change from culture to culture or era to era. Truth is unchanging. That is the fundamental nature of truth as well. If it is objective, then it is unchanging. That's why we listen to ancient math. Because it's true. It was true then and it's true now. And if there are parts of it that we don't listen to now, it's not because the truth has changed, it's because they were wrong. And we've realized they were wrong. Not because the truth has changed. Truth is an unchanging thing. The second bad reason to not follow the Bible is because it's unscientific. Now, what our culture means when they say it's unscientific is that it accepts the supernatural. You see, science, at least the science of our era, practices methodological naturalism. Methodological naturalism, what that means is it rejects the possibility of the supernatural before even considering the evidence. Now, to me, artificially ruling out an option before you evaluate it seems a bit unscientific as far as it goes. Maybe we'll talk about that some more in a minute. Beyond that, the worldview of naturalism, I would argue, is a self-defeating worldview. Now, we don't have time to talk about this. I don't have the expertise to talk about this. I'll let Buddy and Todd deal with these kinds of things in their own time and in their own way. But let me offer you just two examples of this. Science, the scientists will tell you, is based on what can be repeatedly observed. And one of the arguments that you will hear quite frequently is that miracles can't be repeatedly observed, therefore they obviously did not happen. Okay, well, the Big Bang can't be repeatedly observed. Spontaneous generation of life on Earth can't be repeatedly observed. The interspecies steps of macroevolution can't be repeatedly observed. By their own logic, they're not scientific either. Well, wait just a second, they will say. Well, there are singularities. We admit as much. There are singularities. But these singularities are understood in terms of similar regularities. And that's fair. They do say that, and I think that's a fair point. And this is why they argue for evolution, even though there's no interspecies evolutionary links or evidence. What they say is there is obviously what we would call microevolution. They don't like that terminology. But there's microevolution. There's evolution within a species, and there is that regularity. And so they extrapolate out of that the singularity of evolution from one species to another. So repeated experience of similar situations are a sufficient basis for knowing what caused a singular event. Okay, that's great. Now let's start working on some other things in our existence. How about everything coming out of nothing? Repeated regularities proving the singularity. Anyone seen something come out of nothing before? Life coming from lifelessness, order coming from disorder, consciousness coming from unconsciousness, information coming from non-intelligence. On down the line you could go as you look at our world around us. And what you see is the regularities are exactly the opposite all the way down the line. What you find constantly, if I'll hit the right button, is that what you see is things come from things. Life comes from life. Disorder never produces order. Only an ordering force can produce order. Consciousness never comes from unconsciousness. Information always comes from intelligence. So the regularities point to something other than a mindless cause of everything. Our repeated experience shows exactly the opposite of this. And what it all boils down to here is the accusation that the Bible is unscientific has absolutely nothing to do with science and everything to do with worldview. It is the worldview that there is no supernatural. And it begins with the premise that there is no supernatural. And somehow they come to the conclusion that therefore there is no supernatural. It's this mind-boggling thing how they get to that point. Yet that's what it basically boils down to. You start with the conclusion and somehow you wind up with the exact same conclusion. And again, deciding the answer before you investigate, that sounds to me a bit like the fundamental definition of unscientific. So I think this is an accusation that cuts both ways, except if science is really what science is, then it's really unrelated to the issue of the Bible. It's about investigating and learning the true nature of things, not about ruling out an option from the outset. And that's what science kind of is in our culture. Well, that's at least a brief run through, not as brief as I was hoping, but a brief run through of some of the good reasons not to believe. Well, that's not what I meant to say. The bad reasons not to believe and the bad reasons to believe. I think that's what I was getting at. So what are some good reasons to follow this 2,000 year old book? Well, what we're going to do for the bulk of the rest of our time is do what is something of a case study of the Gospels and Acts. That's at least moderately visible there. And what we're going to do is talk about these documents as reliable documents for what they are. And we're going to talk about some things that I hope are relatively new to you, at least some of you. You've heard a lot of different evidences, kinds of things, I'm sure, over the course of your life, a lot of different kinds of things regarding the reliability of the Bible. I hope that what I'm going to bring to you is at least somewhat new, or perhaps I should hope that it's not because you already have this fantastic information in your mind. But either way, hopefully at the end of the night, you'll have something to think about regarding the reliability of these documents. So, first of all, I think we need to start with the fact that the Gospels are history. They are from the genre of history. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that as far as genre studies in the New Testament goes. But broadly speaking, the Gospels are history. And we come to this conclusion for a couple of reasons. First of all, they claim to be history. And when a document makes a claim as to what it's doing, you give that document the benefit of the doubt until it gives you a good reason to not believe it anymore. You have never gone to a library and picked up a book and said, I'm going to read this book. I bet it's a book full of lies that I can't trust a single thing about. That's not how you start reading books. Now, there may come a point where you decide it's a book full of lies because it says that, you know, Teddy Roosevelt sailed across the Pacific Ocean and conquered Russia or something ridiculous. And you say, I'm pretty sure that didn't happen. So maybe I should be a little bit more judicious in my understanding of this book. But generally speaking, you give books the benefit of the doubt to start. Luke says specifically, I'm writing a history of the life of Jesus. John says specifically, I've recorded these things out of the life of Jesus so that you could come to an understanding of who he is. Now he has something of a theological purpose statement. He says he's trying to get you to believe, but that belief is based on the testimony of his life that Jesus is giving. Luke actually gives something of a genre marker in his beginning. You know what a genre marker is. You may not have talked about it that way before, but if you picked up a book and it said in the first line, once upon a time in a kingdom far, far away, you know what kind of book it is just from that sentence. That's a genre marker. It's an identifier right at the outset. Well, if you read the beginning of Luke and the beginning of Acts, and then you go read the beginning of Josephus' work against Appian, and there are other examples of this as well. That's just the most well-known one. It is exactly the same kind of beginning. It's a genre marker of writing a historical narrative. And so unless you can show that there's no good reason not to believe these documents, you have to take them at their word that at least what they are trying to do is write history. Now, whether they can pull that off or not, we're gonna save that question for a minute. But they're trying to write history. And you have good reason for understanding beyond just the fact that they say they're trying to, from a series of what are called undesigned coincidences. Has anyone ever heard of the undesigned coincidences in the Gospels and Acts before? Anybody? Any hands? Anyone who's not been in one of my classes at the college? Okay. This is a really, really old argument that has been basically forgotten for about 150 years. And it blows my mind that no one has thought of this. A friend of mine who's a philosopher at Western Michigan University has kind of resurrected this argument. His wife has recently written a book that really details this. We don't have time to really get into this. But basically what's going on here are the narratives, the various narratives of the Gospels interlock with one another in incidental details in ways that if it were a forgery, it wouldn't have happened that way. If it were a fiction, it certainly wouldn't have happened that way. If it was legendary, it wouldn't have happened that way. We don't have time to talk about loads of examples of this, but let me give you just a few so you can kind of get a flavor of what's going on. In Matthew chapter 26, Jesus is about to be crucified. And at some point, Jesus is challenged to prophesy. Jesus, tell us who hit you. Now, why do they make that charge, that challenge to Jesus to tell us who hit you? Well, you know the answer to that. But the only reason you know the answer to that is because you've read all the Gospels. Matthew never tells us that Jesus was blindfolded. I don't know if you've ever noticed that before. Matthew leaves that out. In fact, you have to go over to Luke chapter 22 to find out that Jesus was blindfolded. And these two little incidental details complement one another and flesh out the story of what's going on there. Because if it's just Matthew's account, prophesy who hit you. Fred, it's you. I'm looking right at you. It's pretty clear who it was that hit me. No, you have to have that other detail for this to really make sense. And again, you've kind of already harmonized them in your mind. You know what's going on. You don't think twice about it. But you really have to put those together. In Matthew chapter 8, we read of a town that Jesus came into where they wait until evening to go to Jesus and ask Jesus to heal their sick. Now, this is a really odd sort of thing. Jesus comes to town. He's widely known. He's this great healer. The moment that they find out that he is there, they should be rushing to him, yet they don't. What they do is they sit around on their hands until evening, and at evening they rush to Jesus and ask for their sick to be healed. Why do they wait so long? Well, Matthew never tells us, but if you go over to Mark chapter 1, Mark tells us it was the Sabbath day. You know how they felt about Jesus healing on the Sabbath. So they wait till the evening, the sun has gone down, the new day has begun by the Jewish reckoning of time. So they rush to Jesus to ask to be healed. The one detail and the one story clarifies another detail and another story in a way that is not forced, it's not contrived, it's not something that, you know, Matthew called up Mark and say, hey Mark, I'm writing a gospel, I'm writing a story of the life of Jesus. Mark says, hey, so am I, that's fantastic. Well, what should we do? How about this? I'll tell a story and leave out a detail, and you tell the same story and include that other detail. That's not how people write things. That's not what happens. But if you're just telling the story, you might leave something out. And if someone else is just telling the story, they might include it and they complement one another. It's not artificial. It's not contrived. It's not forced. It's not any of those things. It's just how history works. And if you read multiple accounts of the same story, whether it's in the Bible or somewhere else, you're going to find this kind of thing happening because this is how history works. Let me give you a really fun one. You know the miracle story where Jesus looks to one of his disciples and asks him, where should we buy some food? You know that story, right? Anyone remember who he asked? Anybody? Philip. He asks Philip. Now, that's a surprising thing because Philip is basically a non-entity in the Gospels. I mean, you see his name in the apostles' list, but that's about it. You don't know anything about Philip. You might expect him to ask Peter. You might expect him to ask John because they're kind of prominent. You might expect him to ask Judas because he's got the money bag, or Matthew because he's a money kind of guy. But Philip, why would he ask Philip this question? Well, in Luke chapter 9, we find out that the miracle happened in Bethsaida. But he doesn't say who he asked. And then if you go back to John chapter 12, you find out that Philip was from Bethsaida. By the way, Mark also mentions that there were really big crowds and really green grass, which seems kind of odd. And John tells us that it was the Passover time when all of this happened. And in Matthew chapter 11, by the way, Jesus issues a woe on the city of Bethsaida for not repenting at the mighty works that they'd seen done. And you say, what on earth does all of this have to do with each other? I'm glad you asked. Well, John's reference to the Passover explains the big crowds and the green grass that he doesn't talk about, because that's the end of the rainy season. Luke's reference to Bethsaida explains Matthew's reference to the mighty works done there. Matthew's not chronological. Matthew hasn't gotten to telling the story of the feeding of the 5,000 yet. That comes later in Matthew's gospel, but it's already happened. But you have to understand from a different context that this has already happened. Luke's reference to Bethsaida, plus John's later reference to Philip being from Bethsaida, explains why Jesus would ask Philip the question instead of someone else. It's his hometown. He would know where to buy bread. All of these little details of all of these different gospels fit together like pieces of a puzzle. One example of this would be a fluke. If every example of this came from John explaining the others because he wrote last, that would be intentional. I've given you three short examples of this. There are enough examples of this to fill a book. I told you it was just written. And every gospel explains every other gospel at some point in one direction or another. My friends, this is not how fiction works. Have you ever been confused at a passage in the Fellowship of the Ring, and so you grabbed a copy of Moby Dick to help understand what was going on there? That's a bit unfair. They're different universes, right? So let's find two historical novels from World War II. Historical fiction from the World War II era. Let's even put them both in Germany. You think they're going to explain one another like this? Not a chance. This is not how fiction works. This is how history works. This is not how mythology works. This is not how legends develop. This is certainly not how planned lies work, where they leave out little details somehow. No, you dot all your I's and you cross all your T's if you're planning a lie and trying to convert someone to a lie that this guy was the Son of God. You're very careful in those cases not to leave out any details at all. What this looks like is history. Independent events being reported by independent witnesses. That's what this looks like, all the way down the line. So they say they're history. It looks like history. Is it reliable history, is the question. Is it reliable history, is the question. I think it's on. Off, on. Now I'm going the wrong way. Well, it is. The end. Well, a couple of things to talk about here along the lines as far as we go. First of all, let's consider Luke as a historian. Now, there are a couple of fantastic studies that have been done on the book of Acts. Now, Acts is not one of the Gospels, of course. One of those is done by a fellow named William Ramsey. William Ramsey was a preeminent archaeologist of the late 19th century who entered in a study of Asia Minor, thank you, a study of Asia Minor as an unbeliever. You can read a couple of his books. They're just fantastic to look at from this sort of perspective. And we don't have time to investigate everything. The bottom line with Ramsey is that Ramsey was an unbeliever. Ramsey was one of the top archaeologists of his day. And when Ramsey was done, Ramsey said, I started with a presupposition that Luke was not reliable, that Acts was not reliable, that it wasn't even written by a contemporary of Paul. It was written by an imposter 100 or so years later, and that it wouldn't tell me anything accurate about this. And I now conclude that Luke was one of the greatest historians who ever lived. That's what Ramsey says about Luke as a historian. You can read more of his work to see more of that. I'm more interested in the study that Colin Hemer did to follow up on Ramsey in the mid to late 1900s. In his book called The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History, in one part of it, he goes through and details 84 specific facts from the final 16 chapters of the Book of Acts that have been confirmed by historical and archaeological research. They include things like ports, boundaries, landmarks, slang, terminology, local languages, local deities, local industries, the right titles for numerous regional and local officials. Remember, this is a non-homogeneous society. This is not a culture where everybody's town leader is called the mayor, and so you just get it right by getting it right once. There are 8 or 9 different specific titles for different places in different regions, and Luke nails every single one of them. In fact, one of the arguments by the skeptics for a long time was that he missed on Thessalonica, because there was no evidence for a long time the term was used in Thessalonica at that time period. Aside from the Bible, of course, that doesn't count as evidence. But outside the Bible, there's no evidence that it was ever used until they found that it was. Luke gets all of them right all the way down the line. And this is a remarkable amount of information that he gets right all the way down. What's more interesting than even that is the accuracy of names in the Gospels. There was a study that was done of 3,000 first century Jewish names. And names were different in different places. The names in first century Palestine do not match the names in first century Alexandria, Egypt, where there was another large community of Jews. They had different names for different reasons. But the bottom line is, if you look at the top 10 names in first century Palestinian Judaism, and you look at the top 10 frequency names in the New Testament, in the Gospels, they match almost one for one down the line. If you look at the top 9 names, the top 9 male names accounted for 41.5% of all the male names in Palestine. In the Gospels, the top 9 names are 40.3% of all the names in the Gospels. This is remarkable correlation. On top of that, they have the right features. You know why every Simon has something attached to his name and Thaddeus doesn't? There's Simon the Tanner, Simon Peter, Simon the Zealot, Simon the Leper, Simon of Cyrene. Simon was the highest frequency name in first century Palestine. You couldn't just walk out on the street and shout Simon, or like 15 people would look at you. But poor Thaddeus, he was the only one. And so you could just say Thaddeus and everyone knew who you were talking about. But that's a remarkable thing, because these documents do this right all the way down. Every name, every time you see a name with a qualifier, it's a top 25 name in the Gospels, top 30 sometimes. Every time you see a name without a qualifier based on the study of Jewish names, it's a low frequency name. How do you get that kind of thing right? As a forger, as a legend, as someone making up a bunch of lies, how do you get that kind of detail right? Now, there is one exception. Jesus is a high frequency name. Jesus doesn't get qualified. That's because Jesus is the chief figure in the entire thing. And if you don't know who he is at this point, you've got bigger problems in your reading of the Gospels. But I will say this also, when someone else is talking about Jesus, it gets qualified. Jesus of Nazareth, he's called, when one of the Gospel authors is quoting the speech. And so they get that right, too, because that's how they would have talked about Jesus. And the place names, the Gospels mention 23 different cities and villages, big cities like Jerusalem, and tiny little towns like Nain and Bethphage. And they know things about them. They know their geography. They know their climate. They know their botany. They know where sycamore trees grow, and they get that right. They know the travel time from one place to another. They know the burial customs in these places. Here's the significance of all of this. All scholars, whether they are conservative or liberal, whether they are believers or unbelievers, all scholars of the Gospels concur that at least 3 of the 4, if not all 4 Gospels, were written outside of Palestine at a minimum of about 30 years later after these things happened. Imagine with me, if you will, that you're an imposter. You've decided to write a false story about a Messiah in France in the 1980s. Write me a convincing story. Write me a historically accurate story. What are the top 10 French names in 1980? Anybody? Pierre and Jacques, we got those, right? Can you even name 8 more French names? How about 23 different cities and villages, and what do you know about them? It's amazing how accurate the Gospels are in these little details. they correctly use slang terminology, Hemer showed in his study. This is a remarkable thing, slang terminology. Any of you parents ever tried to use the current slang with your kids and you've been off by a year? You think about just how many different terms have been used to talk about something that's really, really good. I mean, it's been groovy, it's been gnarly, it's been hip, it's been rad, it's been cool, it's been bad, it's been tight, it's been sick, it's been dope. It's been all kinds of different things along the lines, right? And you've heard most of those. And if you use the wrong one, if you're off by like a month, you look like a poser or whatever the right word for that is these days. Yet the Gospels get the right slang terminology. They know the regional boundaries. They know the names of the kinds of rulers that were in these different places. You hear sometimes about the apocryphal Gospels. If you ever read the Da Vinci Code or saw the movie, it told you these Gospels tell the true story of Jesus. The Jesus seminar that gives more credibility to the Gospel of Thomas than it does to the four canonical Gospels. You hear about all these things. The vast majority of them maybe get one or two names right. Jesus and whoever the title character is of that gospel. The rest of them sometimes don't use names at all. They're just pronouns. Sometimes they have weird, bizarre names that are not attested in Palestine at all. All of them together, if you take up every apocryphal gospel and add it together, it names two cities. Two cities. Jerusalem, that's kind of like us getting Paris right in our French story. Jerusalem and Nazareth, but there's a little bit of a catch on that last one because the one that uses Nazareth thinks that it's Jesus' middle name. And so that's kind of wrong too when you stop and you think about it. And you know how hard it is to remember names, right? How many of you have forgotten a name before? Every hand has to go up here, right? Everybody has forgotten because names are the hardest thing to remember. You can remember stories. You can look at somebody and say, I remember the time we went on a 15-day road trip across the country and the exact place our car broke down, but I have no idea what his name is. Because there's no good reason for a person to have the name they have. It's something that was labeled on them. There's no logical connection. Stories are easy to remember. Names are hard to remember. A British scholar who was talking about this summed it up this way. He said, if the gospel authors have gotten right the detail that's the hardest thing to remember, shouldn't you have confidence that they get the easy part right? And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And there's a single answer that explains everything that we've been talking about for the last 15 minutes or so, and that is they were eyewitnesses, and they're reporting what they saw. That is the single, simplest answer to this issue. Well, really quickly, let's bring all of this together here at the end. Why should we follow this 2,000-year-old book? Well, in light of all of these things, the Gospels tell the story of Jesus. If they are reliable, and I think we have shown that they are, then we need to take what they say about Jesus seriously. Both the claims of Jesus and the evidence that supports the claims. In particular, the amount of evidence that there is for the resurrection, which I know another speaker is talking about later, and so I'll leave that in his capable hands. There is more evidence for the resurrection than just about any other ancient event. Even things that all the skeptics agree actually happened. And if Jesus is resurrected, then his claims have been vindicated. His teaching must be listened to. His followers would continue his teaching. His teaching is the basis of final judgment. He is the only way to God. All of those things are true if Jesus has been risen from the dead. And if the Gospels are reliable, then Jesus has been risen from the dead. And if truth is unchanging, which is where we began, then 2,000 years of technological advancements have not changed the truth of Jesus' teaching. If truth is unchanging, then 2,000 years of scientific progress has not changed the truth of Jesus' teaching. If truth is unchanging, then our culture's rejection of God, our culture's rejection of religion, our culture's rejection of the supernatural has not changed the truth of Jesus' teaching. Why should we follow a 2,000-year-old book? It's really quite simple. Because it contains the eternal, unchangeable will of God to humankind and how it is that we can be in a relationship with Him. Thank you so much for your kind attention.